Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about New Girl in Town. We talk about some cast album chatter. She Loves Me over at the Paley Center, which played for one night. Forever Man at the Nymph. And we also talk about the Nymph itself and what's happening with that and where it's going. As well as congratulations to Jordan Roth and Richie Jackson, who got married.
Just think, inside me our genes have found their niche. They link. Come one tap dancing kid with perfect pitch. What could be better than your own little clone who'll reproduce all your talents plus a hint of my own? Consider this kid'll be a one-man band if we let her.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, July 29th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his photography at followspotphoto.com. You can see his writing and his photography at broadwaystars.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as NPR and the Sondheim Review. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Also with us is Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer. You could see his writing at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critchland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Peter also has numerous books, one of them is which you are working on currently, Peter?
Sure, I'm just writing about Pacific Overtures for this book about musicals that were nominated for the Tony Award but didn't win. So that's what I was doing when you called.
Excellent. And that is scheduled to be released at the Tony Awards in 2013, right?
Right. Yeah.
Great. Excellent. So look Peter and Michael up on Amazon. They have lots of things to offer there. And me, I just buy from Amazon. This morning, we're going to talk about New Girl in Town, which Peter and Michael got a chance to see. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
New Girl in Town, a 1957 musical that, by the way, it was nominated for Best Musical but didn't win, is a show that had a book by George Abbott and a score by Bob Merrill, and was a hit, paid 24% back on its investment. It was the third show to be produced by Harold Prince in conjunction with his partner Robert Griffith. They had previously done The Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, and this one didn't do quite as well as those, but it was a hit. And it must have been really something in its time, because it was an adaptation of Eugene O'Neill's Anna Christie, which, after all, is a story about a woman who's been living as a prostitute and comes back home to see her father, whom she hasn't seen in decades. They last saw each other when she was five. And the thing is, he still thinks of her as a little girl and idealizes her. And she's has a tough time telling him that this isn't quite the case. More problematic is the fact that she falls in love with a young sailor who idealizes her, too. Now, I not only saw New Girl in Town, but I also watched the 1930 movie of Anna Christie. And I have to say that I think Charlotte Moore, who directed New Girl in Town, made a very smart decision in casting Patrick Cummings, a young man, as Matt, the sailor. In the movie, the gentleman who plays the role seems older and experienced.
It's Charles Bickford.
Is it really?
Yes.
I didn't even notice the credits.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
He is too experienced to not suspect something. But the idealism works very, very well with this young man, and this Patrick Cummings is quite lovely in the role. For that matter, Margaret Lesser Robinson is quite lovely too, as Anna. So we really have a very nice coupling here with terrific chemistry. I think the score is very good. There are so many charming songs and lovely ballads and up-tempo songs. You know, George Abbott was famous for saying, well, tonight there'll be a dance. Tonight there'll be a union meeting in the pajama game. Tonight we're going to have an appreciation for Joe Hardy. Anything to get a number in. And that happens too in New Girl in Town. But the songs are good when that happens. There's a nice waltz. There's a march. I mean, the score has a lot of variety to it. So I think it's a good show, and I think it's a good production. I also was very much involved with these characters and wishing them well. It is true that the ending from Anna Christie has been softened a bit, because at the end of Anna Christie, we're not quite certain that this couple is going to get together, that he's going to be able to forgive her. He's going off to sea, and he's going to have some time to think about it. Here, he forgives a little more easily, and but that's musical comedy for you. You know, so you feel bad when he says he's going to get a tattoo on his arm when he falls in line. She doesn't want him to get the tattoo because she hasn't told him the reality, you know. So, and I wonder how many 30-something theater goers will wince at this as they look at their own tattoos that they got 10 years ago and now wished would just disappear, you know. So, but it's much worse for a lovesick man who doesn't know everything about the woman he ostensibly loves to be permanently branded with her name. So it's a little production, needless to say, in Irish Rep, which has a stage that is really, I think, substantially smaller than many suburban living rooms. I mean that. And So it certainly has been minimized, but it doesn't feel wrong. In a way, this is an intimate story. So as a result, I think it fits it very, very well. I was tremendously taken with it, and I recommend it highly. And I'm glad it's not one of those shows that's here for only a couple of weeks and disappears. It's going to be there till September 9th, and I really think it's worth seeing.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Absolutely. We have extolled the Irish Rep on several previous occasions, and this production definitely bears us out. It's a wonderful production. They should give classes in how to stage plays and musicals in a very problematic situation, as I'm sure we've described in the past. The stage itself is quite small, but in addition to that, the bulk of the audience is seated, along one side of the stage, in a narrow but very long block of seats that goes up really quite a way. So if you are towards the back, you sort of feel like you're pretty far away from the stage, even though you're actually, it would be the equivalent of. You're no further back than you would be in a Broadway house, but since it's so narrow and since the stage is so small, it actually feels somewhat further away. And then in addition to that, the adjacent side of the stage also has some seats on it. And so the actors are required to play, at least to a certain extent, to those people also, and it's not easy, especially, I mean, needless to say, the problems are magnified if it's a musical and you have choreography, et cetera, and more people. But anyway, they did a beautiful job of the staging, and I think I absolutely agree about the casting of the leads. Margaret Lesser Robinson, and I can't help wondering if the Lesser, yeah. L-E-S-S-E-R.
I don't know either.
I didn't research it, but that's just an intriguing thing. At any rate, she looked beautiful. She looked the action has been placed here in 1926. I'm not 100% sure where the action of the original play and the movie is supposed to happen. Do you know, Peter?
It's earlier, certainly.
Yeah.
I think they want to get in a few Charleston licks in the choreography because that did show up for a second.
Right. And in a way, I think it wasn't the best decision because there is a lot of the music does have a sort of a ragtimey feel, a wonderful ragtimey feel that is not, I mean, ragtime is really not the 20s, as we all know. But it didn't hurt it in any major way, and there was wonderful touches like a roving saxophone player who's walking around through the action, and the numbers were all wonderful, the up-tempo numbers, which God knows you need in a play, in a musical based on a play by O'Neill, were terrifically well done. as I say, as I started to say, Margaret Lesser Robinson looked like Faye Ray to me, with her blonde hair and her hairstyle. And but she also reminded me of a young Lois Nettleton.
Yes,
Didn't she? Yeah, something about her voice
that
and her.
Hurt to me, but I see exactly what you mean.
Yeah, her voice, her look, her commitment. She had a lovely, very natural singing voice, and she looked great. The guy is, yes, very young, which Peter, as Peter noted, aside from the reasons that he noted, it also, if he's an older guy, not only is he likely to seem more experienced, but also that kind of the reactions he has are harder to take. If it's an older man, if it's a young kid, you think, well, you know, he's still figuring things out and he's kind of naive and he doesn't understand the ways of the world, blah, blah, blah. But this guy looked so young that really wasn't an issue. And it's very important in Anna Christie always to have two leads who have a lot of romantic and sexual chemistry because of the way the play is written. The famous last Broadway revival was Natasha Richardson and Liam Neeson, who basically met on that production and then had so much chemistry that they wound up getting married. So that's the kind of thing that you really need to have. And I thought it was present here also. And also on top of that, Patrick Cummings had a beautiful, I would say, sort of an Irish tenory voice. Mm-hmm. Very, very lovely. So they were, both of those people were perfect casting. Danielle Ferland, How Time Goes On.
Doesn't it?
She, who was Little Red Riding Hood in the original Into the Woods, is now playing Marthy, which is the Thelma Ritter role in the musical, and the Marie Dressler role in the movie. So she was great, and everyone else really modern audiences always get a chuckle that Anna's father's name is Chris Christopherson, we all know as a singer and an actor, but it's spelled differently. It's spelled with CHs instead of K's. And he is very well played by Cliff Bemis, and just very, very well done. I loved it. It's another thing I went into basically cold. I have the cast album, but I have almost never listened to it. I think it's some of Merrill's best work, but it's interesting to me. And what do you think, Peter? I always thought it was ironic. I think he's actually better as a composer than as a lyricist, even though he's much more famous as a lyricist because he wrote many shows where he wrote only the lyrics, primarily or solely to the music of Julie Stein, most famously Funny Girl, and also Sugar, and what else am I leaving out?
Pretty Bell.
Pretty Bell. Yeah. I mean, I think the lyrics, some of them are very good, but then there's some of them that are very clunky, and some he relies a lot on repetition in his lyrics, which sometimes to an extent that I think is a little too far.
Well, we could look at the glasses half full, too. This was his first Broadway score, and at this point, he was most famous for having written such songs as How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? And If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake.
Yeah.
And I would think that people coming to the backers auditions might have been a little nervous about that, you know, that he had not, and here he was taking on Eugene O'Neill. What is interesting to me about the lyrics is that he doesn't have his trademark funky rhymes. For example, kid, my heart ain't made of marble, but your rhythm's really horrible. Some people think that's a horrible lyric, but he liked to rhyme correctly at the expense of the word. There are those who use this type of thing as Exhibit A, that he wrote Elegance and Hello, Dolly, which has long been rumored, because all the guests of Mr. Hackle are feeling great and look spectacular, you know. So, but he did that a lot. He certainly did that a lot in Henry Sweet Henry, too, his 1967 musical.
And
that isn't in evidence this here. You know, I don't think there's even one moment where that happens. But for a first-time debut, I mean, this is pretty good. And frankly, I think his next score was substantially better, Take Me Along. And there were those who like his next score even better, which was Carnival.
Yes.
So, and for those, he wrote both music and lyrics. And But I'd say this is quite a debut, actually. I'd give him most promising composer lyricist as a result of New Girl in Town. And I've been very fond of this cast album, and this is only an opinion. But I think of all six albums, cast albums that Gwen Verdon made, I think this is the one on which she sounds the best. So but here's a chance for our listeners who have all six to go to them and have a Gwen Verdon festival, which is never a bad idea, and see if you agree. You know, I do think for me this is the one where she excels vocally.
We've been having a discussion on the this really terrific cast recordings page on Facebook, and aside from everything else, it seems that New Girl in Town was, I believe, the first stereo cast album on RCA, and they did a really excellent job of it. And yes, Verdon sounds great. She sounds very fresh. She sounds very well, you know, I mean, she's
hopefully
always
in command in a way that isn't always the case.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, for those listeners out here who are, and I don't know why you wouldn't be, avid readers of Peter Felicia's columns, in his Masterworks Broadway column this week, he talked about mistakes that were made on cast albums and some great backstories. Peter, why don't you give us a little snippet of that? I'll put a link in the show notes so people can go read the rest of it, but the story about Dolly was great.
Well, actually, this is this was spurred by Larry Blank, the orchestrator who three times has been nominated for a Tony. Because I had mentioned that there was a mistake in the overture of 110 in the Shade, that 58 seconds into it, somebody plays a really sour note. Mm-hmm. And he wrote in to say, you know, actually, the problem was they never intended to put that overture on. This was just a sound check. That's all it was. So nobody thought anything of the fact that he had played a bad note. So what? You know, I mean, because it wasn't going to get on the album. But as time went on, they found it and they put it on the album. So now it really, and I started thinking of all the mistakes that have happened during the years, yes, Carol Channing came in a little too early. Put on your Sunday clothes. You can hear her say, which is supposed to say Ermengarde, you know, and it's very interesting, you know, that I dare say that was the last time that Carol Channing made that mistake, because she certainly had ample opportunity to rectify that as the years went on, because she played Dolly quite a few more times. Anyone could whistle in Me in My Town. Somebody comes in with one too many dutes. But, you know, when you think of it, if you've ever seen that Pennebaker film about the recording session of Company, it's amazing that more mistakes don't happen. People have not had that much time with this material. They're in a studio. They're not used to being in front of a microphone on stage. You know, their muscle memory and all that takes care of that, and they know what they're supposed to be doing. But a microphone is a different thing entirely, and they're stopping and they're starting, and it's very easy to get confused. If you've ever been to an original cast album session, I mean, really, it's fascinating to see how many times they start and stop and take 904 and all that kind of business, and we'll patch that in, and well, we like that one, but let's see if we can do this. And so it's amazing more mistakes haven't been made in cast albums. Little Ebner has one in Put 'Em Back, which is worth listening to too, when somebody says put one time too many, and one wonders if indeed it's a little Ed Woodish in the sense that nobody will notice that, or if nobody noticed while it was happening. Yeah. It's a real question. I mean, Lord knows we all make mistakes. I've certainly made my share, Lord knows. But nevertheless, I think we should really, again, look at the glasses half full here and think of how well cast albums do turn out, considering that the cast hasn't been doing them that long, and they're in an alien environment. environment while they're doing them.
Well, but, also in Miss Channing's defense, there's also an edit right at that point.
Sure.
And I think that may account for some of the errors on the cast albums. Because all of a sudden there's an edit that they've never done before.
Right.
And I'm actually amazed that Follies doesn't have lots of mistakes like that. And maybe they cut them out, because that must have been, oh God, for those people, the way that score is just hacked for the original cast album, because they tried to fit it on one LP stupidly. It's rare that a verse goes by without some kind of a cut, and I guess maybe they really relied on the conductor and just maybe notes that they had in their hands. I don't know, but at any rate, I don't notice any actual errors on the Follies album.
Well, this is interesting, because of course we do have this new remastered Follies from Bruce Kimmel, and I'm also reminded of She Loves Me. I remember hearing at the time when the Follies album came out, one of the reasons that it was one disc had a lot to do with She Loves Me, because She Loves Me was recorded on two discs. Remember, this was a Harold Prince show too.
Yes.
And there was a feeling that She Loves Me did not sell as well as expected, because people did not want to shell out the money for two discs as opposed to one.
Right.
So they said, well, maybe we better put Follies on one, because it'll just be too expensive for a lot of people. That was something I heard at the time. I only heard it once at the time. That was it. I've never heard it since, and this may be totally untrue, but Michael, this you have the new Follies album, and you went to see She Loves Me. I hate to take James' role here, but I mean, nevertheless, I guess this is a logical segue for you to talk about both the new Follies album and the She Loves Me.
Yes, well, the Follies has been very wonderfully remixed and remastered and reissued on the Kritzerland label, Bruce Kimmel's Kritzerland label. And I would say overall, it's a great success. It's hard to explain it, but it just sounds clearer and fuller and just better in general. Obvious difference is that they have removed what apparently was some after-the-fact decision to have certain of the vocals coming from the far right or the far left speakers. I know specifically in at the beginning of, I believe, Don't Look at Me, on the version of the recording that we've all known for since 1971, Dorothy Collins is, if I recall, probably way to the right. But now she's in the center. And, it's a matter of opinion of what sounds better, but it tends to sound a little unnatural, I think, when the voices are hard panned to the right or the left like that, especially if it's not done really well. So that's one thing that you'll notice right away. The other differences are not maybe so obvious. It's more a cumulative effect. I did notice a couple of moments that I thought they made the wrong decision, where it sounded like they actually added reverb, not to the voices, but to the orchestra. And this resulted in a less sharp feeling. And the two places I noticed that are at the end of the Waiting Around for the Girls Upstairs, and also the very last chord of the show. It seems to me that they now have more echo or more space around the orchestra. And I personally don't think that was the best choice. But I don't want to focus on that, because overall it was really, really terrific. And yes, briefly, I did go to the Paley Center yesterday to see a screening of She Loves Me, I don't have the exact date now, but it was the 70s BBC television production of She Loves Me. And Mr. Harnick, Sheldon Harnick, who we had as a guest on our podcast a few weeks ago, was there. He also, they previous to that, they showed a a screening of The Canterville Ghost, a musical that he and Jerry Bock wrote for ABC Stage 67, which was the same series in which Evening Primrose was presented. And I didn't see that. I only caught the end of it. But he spoke about both that and She Loves Me and took questions and it was a wonderful, wonderful time. The She Loves Me, although not perfect, is a very, very solid, very good, beautiful production overall. It's survives in very good technical form. It's in color and the picture and sound look and sound great. And as Mr. Harnick said, I believe on our podcast and yesterday during the Q&A, it's quite extensively edited, but the edits for the most part are done so well that sometimes you don't even notice them until they're gone or even after they're gone. And also the cast is quite strong. Robin Ellis and Gemma Craven as George and Amalia. And I noticed the guy who sings, the fellow who sings the role of the waiter, the head waiter or the maitre d' or whatever he is, a romantic atmosphere, is the fellow who sings the Candyman in the movie of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I cannot can't find his name at the moment. But lovable little, wonderful little things like that. A really beautiful production of a musical that never got a film. Mr. Harnick talked about that. I didn't know the details. I knew that Julie Andrews was right to have starred in a film, but he filled in a little bit. He said it got so far as that he was called out to Hollywood by Blake Edwards and I can't remember who the other person was, but at any rate, they actually had a models of the sets of the film.
Wow.
And so, Mr. Harnick said, "Oh, how wonderful. This is great." And he said, "Is there any chance that this won't happen?" And Blake Edwards said, "Oh, absolutely not." And then Mr. Harnick said he got on a plane, and when he got off the plane, he picked up a paper that said that Kirk Kerkorian had just come in as the head of MGM
yeah.
and was throwing out a whole raft of projects that he considered to be not viable, not commercially viable. And that was one of them. But otherwise, we would have had a film of She Loves Me with Julie Andrews.
Did he mention Dick Van Dyke? I was heard he was up for it, too.
He did not mention anyone else. I also heard, I believe, that Daniel Massey, who did the show on Broadway and who then starred with Julie in Star, I think he was being considered also. But it never got to, obviously, it never got to that point.
So if there were a TV soundtrack of She Loves Me, that would be one disc.
Presumably. Mm. Yeah, that whole thing is interesting, Peter. I mean, that has been, that theory was very prominent for several years, people would not necessarily buy two LPs or two CDs where they would buy one. But I think that... first of all, I think that applies mostly to like the mass consumer.
I agree.
Anyone who's into a niche product.
That's
like
right.
Broadway, I'm sure that every Broadway cast album enthusiast would absolutely have bought the two LP version of Follies. I mean, maybe they were still in the mindset of the days when Broadway music was popular music. And
see, that's it. Reason She Loves Me didn't sell had less to do with the fact that it was two records than
right.
the fact that now we were starting to be in the era where people were buying fewer cast albums.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, it's a shame that we're talking about these wonderful events after the fact, although we did talk about the Paley Center
yes.
thing coming up a while ago. But it's so sad that these things are just one-offs because they sound so great. Every time I hear you talk about it, it's like NFL films. Whenever they replay a game, they make it seem like the game of the century. And when you guys are talking about this, I'm like, oh, I should have been there, and I was with my kids at IKEA, and I could have been there. And
well, yes, but yes, to our credit, we did give notice of the Paley Center.
Yeah.
And Peter, I can only assume Peter had some commitment he couldn't break because I didn't see him there. And I know that She Loves Me is it fair to say your favorite show?
No, I don't think it's a favorite, the favorite, but nevertheless, certainly it's
way up there.
It's a masterpiece. you know, I have said that on several occasions. I think it's a perfect musical. The thing is, much like the Follies, I have to say that that I do miss what isn't there. So that while I'm glad, you know, it's like when you go to a museum and you see a statue that's a million years old and they filled in pieces with concrete because they don't have everything. You know, that's what both the Follies cast album and the TV She Loves Me reminds me of. It's wonderful to see what we have, but I can't help for yearning for more on both. So, yeah. You see, the Follies cast album for me, you know, was perfectly decent when I got it back in 1971 because I just didn't know any better. I mean, Yes, I had seen the Boston tryout, but nevertheless, I wasn't that familiar with it after one hearing to know that, oh, something's missing here, something's missing there. You know, and it was not until I got that Sondheim Scrabble album that I realized that there was more to I'm Still Here. I didn't hear I'm Still Here in Boston. I heard Can That Boy Foxtrot. Mm. So that was a brand new song to me on the album, and I thought that was all there was to it. You know, so the edits didn't bother me back then. You know, they have since bothered me, needless to say, now that I know the show like the back of me hand. So,
well, you know, we talk about the greats and the big ones here, the Follies, the She Loves Me's. We have big shoes to fill when we talk about Forever Man. So, Michael, why don't you start us off on Forever Man?
I really didn't like it overall. It's a musical about eternal life. These people who, these doctors who invent a serum that can give eternal life, and how that is used or misused. But then there were other plot elements sort of piled in on top of that, that it seemed like a very overstuffed musical. I thought the production was very good as far as the direction and the just the, you know, the various production elements of it. But the score seemed like it was kind of written in the Les Mis crossed with Jekyll and Hyde mode. It didn't, with no regard really whatsoever for any kind of stylistic consistency from one song to the next as far as to what period it sounded like. In this case, the action takes place basically in two different periods, 1675 to 76, and then 1849. But you would have, you know, I mean, it could have been any time as far as when the music, what the music sounded like. And also a very, very long show, I have to say. So I don't have a lot to say to recommend it, unfortunately. I'm curious what Peter thinks.
I didn't like it either. The moment it started and the leading man came out and started singing that hushed, Les Mis-y way, I was immediately turned off. I lost interest right away because the ideal scenario, of course, is that every Broadway musical be sui generis, and I know that's a lot to ask, but you really get the impression that this guy saw Les Mis. And as you say, Michael, that hadn't occurred to me, but you're right, Jekyll and Hyde, and said, oh, this is how it's done. Okay, let me write in that style as opposed to finding his own style. So I found it terribly derivative. Here's another one of those shows where the guy wrote book, music, and lyrics, and I think he took on too much. I usually do when this happens. And I hated the leading man who was giving a very arch, pretentious, and totally phony performance. Now, much of this was in the writing. He was doing what he was supposed to do. And I agree with you, Michael. I like the direction as well. You know, and you might say, well, wait a minute, the director directed the leading man. But I'm sorry, that is inherent in what was written. And there was no way around that whatsoever. So, and by the way, what's wrong with eternal life when you don't age and you look terrific? You know, I mean, you know, the upside of that was never discussed. It was always about how terrible it was to live forever. And, you know, all right, fine. But, you know, the wonderful thing about drama is when people play fair. In 1776, John Dickinson is not made to look like a fool. He is definitely somebody who comes up with really good points.
Yes.
Why there should be no revolution. So that's Pacific Overtures, as I say, I was just writing about. Sondheim and Weidman show the good things about opening up to the West and the bad things, too. You know, I mean, you have to be fair to both sides. So while everybody was just so repulsed by the year of living forever and looking good forever, it certainly appealed to me. You know, so I think that should have been addressed, maybe even in a comedy song. But, I mean, if there was a comedy song, I missed it, I have to say. And even Les Mis has Master of the House.
Well, there was that duet at the beginning. And that was actually the high point. I and several of the other people agreed. Those two, Mrs. Morgan and Hawkins, One Small Kiss. It reminded me of actually I Shall Scream.
That's fair, Michael. You're right.
From Oliver.
Yeah, right. Good point. Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah, that's right. You're right. But I'll tell you, I lost interest in it immediately. Mm-hmm. I sat there dutifully, and I certainly admired the way it looked and the staging, and it flowed very nicely in terms of the staging. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the show itself didn't interest me for 2 seconds.
And it had, I have to say, some of the worst English accents I've ever heard in my life. Can someone understand that? Is there a way to put this in a frequently asked questions? Not every in when you're doing a British accent, not every A vowel is ah. You know, they were saying well, for the lost time, and you know, I don't know how you can stand going. Uh-huh. No, those words are not pronounced that way in British English. It's last and stand, not lost and stand. So that drove me up the wall because it was very grating and you know, just didn't mm-hmm. help. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting sometimes when you see a production of Les Mis and the cast will do English accents?
Well, because, two reasons. The property did come by way of England. And
yeah.
Also, you know, it's just traditional, any kind of classic, you know, I mean, why do we have these ancient Romans always talking in British English and Ben?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah, certainly in those 50s movies, that always happened. Yeah.
Very good point, Michael. Excellent. So Forever Man is not forever, as it is part of the Nymph.
I should point out, I believe this is an original musical, right? It's not based on any existing property, right?
No, so. It's not. But also, on top of everything, I think many of us agree that the title has to go. Because it sounds like doesn't it sound like a comic spoof of a superhero?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
It does.
That's fair.
I was sort of thinking of the Bruce Willis movie Unbreakable type of thing where he couldn't get, he lived forever and he couldn't get hurt or the pretension of that movie.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so Nymph is wrapping up today, the 29th of July. You know, generally, overall, how did you feel about the festival this year? And how do you feel about, do you think there's anything that we should be looking forward to coming out of this?
Oh, God, I wish I didn't have to say no. Though I have to say, too, that today I am at 1 o'clock going to see Zapata, so maybe that will be the one that will emerge.
And on a high note, that's right.
Yeah, Mike.
Well, I have to say, I was speaking with someone who was involved with a Nymph show a couple of years ago, and he could not be more negative about the experience. He basically, I think he used the word racket. They have a very the specific thing he objected to was two things. There are apparently a lot of hidden costs. I mean, you're told, according to him, you're told about some of the costs up front, but then you're going on and then it's suddenly like, oh, and by the way, you need to pay for this. And of course, you need to pay us for that. And that adds up tremendously. And then on top of that, there apparently was a big controversy where they, at least on one occasion, tried to get authors to sign things to basically yield their rights to the material to Nymph for a very long time, or I mean, I'm not sure of the details, and that was quashed apparently by the whatever the Dramatists Guild or
yeah, that was that happened over the winter. Yeah.
So I have to say, I mean, when Nymph started, I thought it was a great thing. It seems like for a combination of reasons that over the years it has devolved, and it seems like the quality has gotten overall has generally gotten much worse. It honestly seems like now they will produce anything where they know that the creators have the money to do it, the considerable amount of money necessary to do it. And it seems that it really has nothing to do with the quality or the perceived quality of the scripts and the music and lyrics. And I would not be surprised if Nymph maybe does not go on for much longer from what I'm hearing and seeing and just the terms of both the quality and also the negativity that a lot of the participants are expressing.
I hadn't heard any of that, but that's interesting.
And, well, you'd heard about the rights thing, which is
the rights thing that was big in the news.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But you know what, that sort of thing happens at film festivals. It happens all over the place in businesses and startups. I mean, Nymph might feel, I don't know if this is true or not, they might feel that they are basically a launching ground and a platform for getting these things up. And in this day of venture capital, this is, you know, people take, you know, partial profits out of these things, as does, you know, if you do a workshop of a musical, you know, the original people in Rent are still getting paid. Mm-hmm. The people that did the original Rent workshop and as contributors to the eventual product. But so Nymph moved from the fall to the summer. Do you think it was a good move, or do you think they should move back to the fall, or?
Well, I think we mentioned the fact. Yeah. That I just wonder how many important people with money were out of town and missed the festival. Mm-hmm. That's my only question. Otherwise, I don't think it much matters when they do it. If the air conditioning was good in places, I mean, which was important, and certainly the venues have gotten nicer over the years, haven't they? I mean, the idea of using both the new and the old signature theaters certainly was good. Yes, indeed, the 45th Street Theater, the one near 9th Avenue, which is not a show place, was employed as well. But as the years have gone on, they've been in better theaters.
I believe I heard that was one of the primary reasons for moving the time, moving the slot, because there were those kind of theaters available now, whereas not in the fall.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Sure.
So this next thing that we're going to talk about, it's going to seem like a commercial, but it's not. So stay with us here. I want to remind everybody that August 26th is the closing date for Sister Act, a divine musical comedy. So you only will have, roughly 30 performances or so left to see Sister Act, which will have played, 550 or so performances by the end. And it opened on April 20th, 2011, which was much further back than I thought about. Mm-hmm. But I mention this because Peter and Michael both have Sister stories to share with you, and we'll start with Michael's first. Michael, why don't you tell us your Sister story?
Yes, I just wanted to commemorate the passing of Sister Mary Raymond, whom I've spoken about a few times on the podcast. She was a teacher and director of the shows at St. Joseph Hill Academy on Staten Island for many years. And the thing that was most fascinating about her, as I've said, is that she went out of her way not to do the shows that everyone else does. she did shows like Plain and Fancy. Mm-hmm. She did Happy Hunting.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it was amazing. And actually, I'm happy to say, sadly, she died a few weeks ago after a very full life. So, I mean, you know, in that sense, it was not sad. She had a very full and productive life, and she had an influence on a tremendous amount of young people, obviously. I'm happy to say that I did speak with her just a couple of months before she died. I called her up and I expressed my gratitude to her for that specific reason. And she said, I just could not see, you know, the point of doing just, you know, another production of Oklahoma when there were these other shows that could be done. She wanted for years and years to do a show called Charlie Girl, which is a British musical, and she could never get the rights. But other than that, she went out and we did Where's Charlie right before it was revived on Broadway with Raul Julia back in 76,
somewhere around there, yeah.
And another show I never mentioned is she did Roberta. She did Roberta, which Roberta is famous for giving birth to songs like Smoke It's in Your Eyes and a couple of other Jerome Kern hits, songs that have become standards. But the show itself is basically, I mean, it's just not done. When we got the, I'll never forget this. We got the parts from, I guess it was Tams Whitmark or whoever,
probably, yeah, yeah.
And then the choral parts. We're reading the choral parts, and all of a sudden, there above one of the staffs, it says Burthen, Burthen, and we're like, what is that? There's no character named Burthen. Turns out that Burthen is first of all an archaic spelling of the word burden, but in music it means a recurring line after each stanza of a ballad, etc. Now Stephen Sondheim, as it happens, has his music company, is a publishing company, is called Burthen Music, which I think a lot of people don't know that, but really, I mean, that's how old Roberta is. That's how old the parts were. We may have been the first people to have those sides and those parts since the show was done in 1930 whatever. It was incredible, and really a privilege to be able to work on shows that you know, a lot of professionals can't say they ever have worked on or even seen. So I really did want to acknowledge her for that, and I didn't want that to let her passing go without remarking on it.
You were very lucky, Michael. My experience with Sister Marillac, who ran the drama club at Arlington Catholic High School, was very different. She would not pay any royalties whatsoever, and the only shows we ever did that were shows that were in the textbook, that was it. So as a result, there was Thornton Wilder's The Happy Journey to Camden and Trenton. I may have the cities mixed up. Now, at the time, we were kids, and we didn't realize what a good play this was. What this play is really about is a family's first ever automobile trip. And the thing is, nobody knows how to behave because everybody's fuses are blown. They can't believe that they're actually riding on a road, you know, in one of these horseless carriages. And the kids, you know, misbehave, and the father stops. I'm not moving another inch until you people say, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's very endearing. But Marillac was the type of nun who really believed in surprise endings. She loved those O. Henry stories with surprise endings. So as a result, she said, but nothing happens in this play. The whole point of the journey is they arrive to see their other daughter, who's now married, and we've got to have a surprise ending. So I think that when they get there, and the daughter comes out, the grown daughter comes out, when the husband comes out, and I quote, "Let's make him colored." Well, the thing was, you know, we had no black kids in the school, you know, but sister, we don't, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to get a black ski mask and we're going to put it on Willie Waylon and he'll be the, really. So as I said, James, if you want to cut this story, I totally understand. But that's what happened back in the 60s at Arlington Catholic High School.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that this did happen and that we were all cognizant enough to know that it's atrocious of what has happened. We can't deny our past. We can't. But
right.
I tell you, it's a it's interesting how much kids are more in tune with what's right and what's wrong than sometimes adults are. It's sad.
Yes, I think that's really true.
Yeah,
we were all pretty horrified, but what can I tell you? Oh, by the way, the show did not go on. We eventually talked her out of it, and that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. Instead, we did I Remember Mama, because that was in the textbook as well. You know, so we did that. I Remember Mama was, of course, a play about Scandinavian people, and there's a scene where an uncle sings a little Norwegian ballad to the girl, to a little girl. Well, I insisted that we not use that. I insisted we use the Dutch ballad that's used in Here's Love. There's a song where Santa Claus sings in Dutch to a little girl, and that was the one I insisted we use. You know, and Marillac didn't fight me on it, and that's the one we used. So, but I had to have this new Broadway song in this show. It was very important to me to do it. So, and given that I was playing Uncle Chris, therefore I was able to manipulate that.
So yesterday I was flipping through Facebook, and there was a great photograph of Jordan Roth and Richie Jackson with standing in front of a building in New York City saying they just got their marriage license. And I looked at it and says, oh, Jordan Roth got married. That's great. And Charlotte, my four-year-old, walked over and looked. She goes, they are so happy. And that's what it, you know, it's the kids, they,
that's it.
Doesn't matter to them. It's two guys getting married. And it shouldn't matter to anybody, but it's great.
The day is fast approaching, where anybody who starts fighting this is going to be regarded the way we regard people who belong to the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
It's true. It really is. And the sooner the better.
I hope so.
So we have a little bit of a scandal. I don't know if it's a scandal or not, but there's a little bit of a pushback on the West Coast at La Jolla. At La Jolla, they have an original show called The Nightingale, who was written by the Tony Award-winning team of Duncan Sheik and Steven Sater. And it's set in China, and it's cast with mostly non-Asians. And the Asian community in La Jolla is protesting this, that there's two Asians in the cast, and that the main leads are played by Caucasians. So it's very interesting because I've not heard a lot about this here in the New York media, but it seems to be in the West Coast media a lot. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard about it, read about it?
Mm-hmm. Well, just recently. I mean, my position is I don't know enough about the property. Aside from everything else, I don't know enough about the property, which apparently is an allegory or a satire. So the extent to which the characters should be played by actual Asians is even more open to question for that reason. So I don't want, I personally don't want to weigh in. But it's interesting, just to tie things together. Richie Jackson, who we just mentioned, used to be partnered with B.D. Wong, who led an effort, who was at the center of a controversy over the casting of Miss Saigon on Broadway, specifically
Jonathan Price.
Yes, Jonathan Price in the role of the Eurasian pimp, the engineer. So this is something that this is an issue that I'm sure is going to keep coming up again and again. I don't see how it can be, you know, quote unquote, resolved, because partly because every instance is different, and some people are going to say, well, this is different because this is, you know, because of who wrote it, or because of the style of the piece, because it's a comedy as opposed to a drama, etc. Maybe it's good, maybe it's good to have the discussion, but
well, going back to Pacific Overtures, looking at the list of people who were in that, there certainly were unfamiliar names to most of us. Sab Shimona we knew from being in MAME, but nevertheless, aside from James Dibas, all the other names were Asian names. And that was 76, which was 15 years before Miss Saigon and 30-odd years before now. So, it's so interesting to me that leave it to Sondheim and Prince to do it right. And John Weidman too, for that matter, to do it right, to say, no, we're going to get the real things. In William Goldman's books, The Season, he points out the fact that when A Majority of One was produced on Broadway, this was in the 50s, granted, that Sir Cedric Hardwick played the Japanese part. And then when the movie was made in the 60s, Alec Guinness played the part. So it was so interesting. And God knows Flower Drum Song certainly had people who were not true Asian performers. So it's surprising to me that this is still an issue. And I would think today that automatically Asians would be cast in Asian roles. And there are so many schools now that provide musical theater training. I would think there would be several casting possibilities. But Michael, you're right. We don't know what this show is.
I know Pacific Overtures, and to me, it would make no sense to cast those roles with non-Asians.
Sure.
But I cannot say about The Nightingale.
Let me ask you about Lincoln Center Theater production of Carousel, mm-hmm. Where the Snow Kids, mm-hmm. during that production, it was in 94 or so. The Snow Kids were all of multi-ethnic, that looked like a Benetton ad.
Sure.
When it was at the this production of Carousel came from National Theatre in London. Do you know if the National Theatre production, the Snow Kids, were multiracial or?
Well, I don't know that, but I do know that in London the races of the Snows themselves were reversed. I believe in London, Mr. Snow was black and Carrie was white, but of course on Broadway it was Audra McDonald and Eddie Corbett.
All right, well, let's move on to other things happening over in London. Danny DeVito and Richard Griffiths are leading the Sunshine Boys, and rumor has it's coming into New York. So we're looking forward to a Sunshine Boys.
I am. I think it's a great play, and I will reiterate the word great. It may be Neil Simon's best play. Certainly Barefoot is a lot of fun, and Odd Couple has a lot of truth in it. But Simon really understood these vaudevillians of yore. And I don't know if you ever saw the TV remake, which is very sad because time had passed by the idea of that doctor's sketch. But writing about Lewis and Clark, who were really Smith and Dale prototypes, it's a terrific play. So I do hope it comes here. I can't say that this strikes me as the most logical casting, but nevertheless, I'm willing to see what it's going to play like, and I'm very interested. So I hope it does come here.
And the Sydney Theatre production of Uncle Vanya is a very hot ticket right now. It's playing at the Lincoln Center Festival, and there's discussion that it's going to transfer to a Broadway house.
Wow. Imagine. It wasn't that long ago we had an Uncle Vanya at the Atkinson that did no business whatsoever. That's a tough play.
I think it's probably just selling on Cate Blanchett.
Yeah.
Of course.
I do wonder what is the rationale behind them bringing that and not Streetcar, which was a tremendous success a few just a few years ago when they did it, when that company did it. Maybe people just weren't available at the time. Maybe it just came down to that.
And other things in the news, Ghost has announced its final performance August 18th, but it's still going strong over in London. So interesting that we have yet another transfer that didn't seem to work out as well as we thought it would be from a very popular movie.
I guess they'll have to stop singing here right now. They'll have to change it to Gone Away.
Broadway and Broadway set their date for September 9th. I'm sort of remembering we didn't have Broadway and Broadway last year, did we? Because of conflict with the 9/11 anniversary. Was that true? Do we remember?
I had forgotten, but I think you're right.
Yeah, so it's our 20th Broadway on Broadway. It's September 9th, so if you are out of town, make your plans to get into New York to see that now.
What's always nice about that, too, is you're with people who really care.
Yeah.
And that's what's so nice. No matter who's performing up there, there are people who in that audience who know exactly who they are, and that's the fun of it. Of course, we always hope it's going to be a nice day, not just because of rain, but I mean of heat. You know, if indeed it's a nice day, it's a great way to spend an afternoon.
I remember at least two moments that I'll never forget from Broadway on Broadway. One was Liz Callaway singing Memory from Cats. And I can't explain it to you. It was just something about the way she sang it, the way she hit that high, the climax with the high notes at the end. The crowd went absolutely nuts. And that we're talking thousands of people. It was thrilling. I would love to ask her about that moment. I'm sure she cherishes it as well. It was one of those once in a lifetime things. And the other one was I got to see a number from Busker Alley at Broadway on Broadway, because that's how close the show came to actually coming in. And then, of course, it was all canceled. So Marshall Lewis and Tommy Tune wasn't in the number. I don't remember. It was Marshall Lewis and I think there was a dog in the number.
Uh-huh.
Is that right? Anyway, but yeah. So you never know what you're going to see at on Broadway.
Lizzie is doing Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset Boulevard, yeah.
In Pittsburgh now.
We talk about Danielle Ferland growing up, and yeah. Liz Callaway has too. I mean,
from
no
baby
question.
To Norma, you know?
Yeah.
We should get Liz on the show. I'm sure she would do it.
Lovely lady. And by the way, all CD players may be different, but I'll tell you, her voice on my CD player is the best of anybody's. Somehow it just melds beautifully with my CD player. So opening song of Baby, what could be better than that? Ah, glorious how she sounds
of
that.
And speaking of Bruce Kimmel, his album that he did for Liz, her first solo album called The Story Goes On, and I guess that's when it was, well, what label was that? It wasn't
that was Finsworth Valley, maybe?
That was before Finsworth. It was
Various a band?
It was Various. Yeah.
Yeah. That is one of the few albums of that type that I still constantly listen to this day. It's as you say, Peter, her voice, there's something about her voice that just I mean, it sounds great live too, but it just lends itself to the recording medium. Mm-hmm. And she's one of those people who have I could go on and on. She's one of those people who when you first hear her, you think, well, her voice isn't like terribly distinctive, maybe. I mean, in the sense of it's not quirky at all, but it's so straightforward. It's like almost like you're hearing the song in its purest form, you know.
That's right.
And she treats the lyrics, you know, like it seems like she's saying them and not acting them. You know what I mean? Everything is entirely natural and pure, and she's really just one of our greatest performers. I agree.
Speaking of good weather for Broadway and Broadway, good weather is very dependent upon our plays in Central Park, where Into the Woods is playing now and had some stress because of all the terrible storms that we had over the last couple of weeks. And the first night of Into the Woods was a bit bumpy, according to some. One of them being Morgan James, who was an actress that we saw in Godspell. And she tweeted something on Twitter, and a poor thing took on a life of its own. And
I guess we're contributing to right now. Yeah.
Yeah. but it's part of a large discussion of do actors have the right to have an opinion about stuff, and what is, you know, in this new world of everything is on Twitter, is this something really to be paid attention to or not? And
well, it's funny. What comes to mind to me immediately is the fact that critics are often criticized for being so harsh. And yet, when I'm at a party and I'm with actors and certain shows come up,
yeah, absolutely.
You know where I'm going with this, huh? Yeah. You know, I find that they're much harsher in giving opinions of shows and performances than critics are. So,
it's kind of unfair because, you know, obviously actors are going to have opinions. I mean, if they didn't have opinions, what good would they be? You know,
sure.
I mean, I'm sure they're as passionate or more so about their art as everyone else, but it's just one of those things where, you know, can I say don't shit where you eat, you know, where they most of them feel that they can never say anything negative about anyone because they might be working with them or have an opportunity to work with them at some time in the future. So, you know, whereas others of us, you know, are not quite in that same position. So it's tricky, you know. I mean, and this was compounded by the fact that it was the first preview. So then there's that on top of everything else that you know, people feel that regardless of whether she was an actress or a critic or whomever, that she should have, you know, given them the benefit of the doubt and waited. You know, it was the first, very first preview after an apparently very difficult tech period that was made more difficult by the weather and having to cancel rehearsals due to the weather and things like that.
Well, the voice
this
of
is
reason,
America. She has every right to say what she wants to say.
Absolutely, the voice of reason. You know who I mean? Michael Riedel was saying that that for some reason there were not monitors in the front of house, so the actors couldn't see entrance cues and things like that given
and
by the conductor.
Right,
by the conductor. So, you know, typically there are video monitors left, right, and center stage at some point so the actors can see the conductor giving cues.
That surprises me because it's not as if they've never done a musical.
Absolutely, but I wonder... You know, it could have been a technical problem. It could have, you know, they didn't have a chance to tech because of the rains and things like that. So maybe they just stumbled through this. Lewis Black is coming to Broadway with his show, and this is, you know, certainly nothing new. We've had lots of comedians come to Broadway before and short runs, but it seems like we're getting more and more of them. And do we really consider them shows? Or they're just coming to the stand-up act? I don't consider them shows.
No.
You know, 700 Sundays, I didn't really consider a show, and the various other folks we've had here. And I wonder, I haven't seen the Mike Tyson show, but that's coming up soon. And I wonder if we would really consider that a monologue or just a show. Or
I personally, James, would say that 700 Sundays was very different. That was a much more of a scripted piece. I mean, I realize that stand-up acts are scripted also, but somehow it had the feeling of more of a play for me. But, you know,
certainly because of the set, too.
Yeah, but we, I mean, you know, we were splitting hair. I guess there's really no point in defining them. But the issue is going to be which, if any, of these are or aren't eligible for Tony Awards.
Well, the other thing is bring back that special category. And if Lewis Black ended up on the Tony Awards, would that bring a whole new audience with us?
No. There's no new audience, no matter who does anything.
That's absolutely true. I agree with you, Peter Felicia. Once again, you speak the truth. All right. So as was foretold in Hershey a few moons ago, A Christmas Story is coming to Broadway. And that's going to play the Lunt. And So we're going to have Christmas Story coming in, and Seuss's Grinch Who Stole Christmas is going to play the Paramount at Madison Square Garden. So we have our holiday fair starting to line up as well in these end of July dog days of summer.
So
we know
July.
We know what we'll be doing. You know, those Crazy Eddie commercials.
Interesting how, you know, you never know when things are going to actually pan out. And it must be so exciting for Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. Am I pronouncing those right?
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the score for both Christmas Story and for Dogfight, because Dogfight has just opened off-Broadway. And I mean, I'm not sure if it's a limited run or if it will still be running, but at any rate, even if not, it's so close to A Christmas Story coming to Broadway. So what an exciting time for them.
Friday afternoon, I went to see their children's musical, James and the Giant Peach.
Oh.
So they have been busy. Yes, indeed.
We were going to talk about Dogfight this week, but Michael is actually going this afternoon. We will talk about Dogfight next week. We're going to talk about Last Smoker in America next week. Last Smoker in America. I stumbled through that, excuse me. And I'm going to try to get Bruce Kimmel on the phone, and we'll see if we can interview Bruce next week and talk about the re-release of Follies and the remastering. So we have lots of stuff going on. Anything else going on this week coming up for you two? Michael, you going out to P-Town?
I'm going on the weekend, but before that, I'm going to see Bring It On.
Oh, yeah.
And then Into the Woods, actually, the night before I leave for P-Town. So that's, I'm really excited about that.
Great. Peter, when are you seeing Into the Woods? Are you seeing Into the Woods?
Yeah, the 6th for Into the Woods and the 8th for Bring It On. So I'm going to be a little behind Michael on this one, on these.
Okay, so we'll Into the Woods and maybe Bring It On. We'll talk about in 2 weeks instead of next week. So great. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. And on the right-hand side, there is a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, you will be able to get it automatically into iTunes. If you do listen to us on iTunes, please leave us some reviews, because Apple weighs them very heavily in promoting our show, and that would be great. You can also listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is available for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your iPod Touch, well, lots of different smart devices. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you want to reach out and leave some feedback for us, all of our contact information and show notes are available at BroadwayRadio.com. We have lots of links to different stories that we've talked about, different topics, everything else that's happening there, as well as contact information for Peter, Michael, and me. So I guess on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a great week.
Okay.
You hear them calling a Peter and Pat. She wears a rain cloud instead of a hat. She still remembers the day that they met. She may forgive him, but never forget. An angel's heart became a devil's prize. The sunshine.